Buglers, we are live from Leicester Square Theatre on the 16th of September with Chris Addison and Alice Fraser. It might be our only London date of the year, so get your tickets now. Oh, get them at thebuglepodcast.com. That bit's important.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, welcome to Tiny Revolutions with me, Tiff Stevenson, the podcast where I speak to comedians, actors, writers, directors, performers about the political movements, art, films and television that has been revolutionary to them, or a tiny revolution at least. My guest this week is, how would I describe him? Comedian, actor, podcaster, writer, producer, senior correspondent, or I believe senior Latin correspondent for The Daily Show. It's Al Madrigal.
Hello. Hi. How are you? Great to see you again.
Great to see you.
I just want to say, yeah, you were so nice to me when I was in London. I was in London for 2 months, and I just want to say that Tiff is one of the best people, because a lot of comics wouldn't have taken the time, and you were so, so kind to me and welcoming. So I will always have a fond place in my heart for Tiff Stevenson, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, it was all a plot just to get you to do this podcast like a year later. Oh, it's probably 2 years now since you were in London, is it?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, 2 years. Crazy. And that movie still hasn't come out yet.
Yes, I just I read about it on your Wikipedia, because I know you. It's always very odd going on to, let's get that out of the way, going on to people's Wikipedia, like a summary of who they are, because you go, I know this person, and I knew you were shooting a film and you weren't allowed to talk about it, but it does say on Wikipedia what the film is. It's a Marvel film, correct?
Yeah, and also it's it was supposed to come out in July of 2020 and has been pushed to January 22. So I think the all of the hush-hush top secret treatment that those types of movies get, is that's all out the window. So it just doesn't matter at this point. Who cares about anything, Tiff?
Who cares about anything anymore? Well, this is a perfect podcast for during this lockdown time, because we are going to talk about stuff that you love and stuff that's influenced you and stuff that's been revolutionary. And I will start at the very, very start. So what drove you in the first place? So obviously you're excellent at what you do. That's why I get people on. I'm like, oh, they're a tiny revolution. I watch them. I love them. Was this always the plan? Was this like by design that you ended up doing stand-up, or was it a completely different plan?
Well, I loved stand-up comedy from a very young age. I just loved television. There was an old show here, and I'm not sure if it's ancient, first days of HBO, called Dream On. You remember that with Brian Benben?
Oh yes, it was all about TV, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I was that kid. The title sequence has a boy just sitting in front of, plopped in front of a television, and both my parents worked full time, and so I was raised by TV and just loved it. I loved everything comedy, and would write. There was a SCTV's Second City Television with Rick Moranis, Martin Short, John Candy, Eugene Levy,
Catherine O'Hara, right?
Yeah, so, that's right. So just amazing cast. So I watched that, and it was scrambled, and I'd be able to watch half of it and try to watch that in a bold black and white television. And then luckily, my neighbors were comedians. Ah. So down the block was this guy, Michael Meehan. And then across the street a little bit was Robin Williams' influence, this guy, Michael Pritchard. And then at my high school, David Letterman used to have a local comedian on that he started with named Bob Sarlat. So on career day, every single career day in my high school, there was a door that just said comedy.
Wow.
And he would show his old Letterman tapes and VHS tapes that he would go and show us all. And then he was the voice of Waffalo Bill. So he talked to us about a career in voiceover, and he talked to us about acting and all the roads that comedy led to. And so I remember going to that for 4 years, knowing it was a job. But then something interesting happened where we grew up very poor when I was little. My mom got a job as a secretary in a company and ended up rising through the ranks of that company and buying the company out from the owner and quadrupling it in size. So this is happening while I'm in high school, and this is happening as I'm graduating college. I was never a good student, just always grifting as much as I possibly could, take, you know, finding tests, fishing tests out of a, you know, garbage can. I had keys to the place. I was just, if you remember the movie Rushmore with Jason Schwartzman.
Yes. Yeah.
I did that. It just was a member of every single club and had an article in the newspaper with it student
blows.
Body.
Blows my mind, right? What you're telling me now, the idea that you, just to go back to that before we move on to your mom's business and talk about your parents, because I would love to talk about your sort of earliest political influences and stuff, but that the idea that when you went into school and there was a door that said like that was a career option, because here that just, I think anything in the arts, and I think this could be a class thing, which is also quite interesting. I think working class people in the UK are very much encouraged to not, like the art isn't something that could be a career or have money behind it.
That's true.
So the idea that you could just walk into it, like on careers day, there was someone there going, this is a job, by the way. Just being a funny smart ass is a job. So it was something you always thought you could do. There was nothing to say to you, Al Madrigal can't do stand-up, because you can see someone doing it, making money at it, right? And you live on the block.
Well, my parents said otherwise because they wanted me to join this family business. But the fact that I knew it was a job, so from an early age, and then I was able to, you know, pursue it once I saw 30 coming. So I started doing stand-up. My very first set was when I was 28 years old.
Right.
And then
mine too, I think exactly the same.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Yeah. And which is not ancient, but on the brink of being possibly too late to really just put in the effort that you need to. And when we do talk about starting and, you know, the 10,000 hours, you know, or whatever, there has to be a tremendous amount of effort in the beginning for sure. Because you're meeting other comedians, you're finding about, you know, out about all these opportunities, and it takes a lot of work to get good. I remember someone asked me to teach a comedy class. It was a disaster because I remember telling the class that they needed to invest about 14 years.
Right. And everyone went, forget that.
No, this is horrible. We just want to dabble. I don't understand. We just trying to be funny at work. Yeah.
Well, if you had any idea, I often think this, I'm always fascinated to ask other comics this, like, if you had any idea how long it would take to get good and find your voice, would you have still done it?
I would have just started so much earlier.
Right. Okay. Right. You still done it. You just started earlier.
Yeah. I'm the exact same age as Arj Barker.
Right.
And I remember walking in and if you don't know who Arj Barker is, he's absolutely hilarious. He's a San Francisco comedian. Yeah. Who went to Australia. And I remember first night in the San Francisco Punchline watching on a Sunday night, watching Arj do a set and just kill and be his smart, brilliant self, and thinking, oh, okay, that's where the bar is. All right. Rise to that level. And that was what was great about San Francisco, is that we had Patton Oswalt and Blaine Kapach and, you know, just brilliant comedians coming out of the city. Greg Proops.
I love Proops as well.
Yeah. There's, I mean, so many very funny comics. Sue Murphy. You can go on and on and on. So San Francisco was one of those great sort of comedy feeder cities before you got to, you know, LA or New York. So the bar was high there. And watching Arj, who started when he was 18, I knew I had a lot of catching up to do. So he had a 10-year jump on me. I just wish if I could go back, and I knew the you know, length of time you need to dedicate to this profession, I would have just pulled a Dave Chappelle and started when I was 15.
Right. Just an absolute baby. But I think the older you get, the more you have to say. And
that's what I was just going to say, the same thing. Yeah, the flip side is that we had life experience. So I had something to discuss. So at the parents' family business was firing people. So I fired people for a living.
Tell me about that then. So your mom manages to buy this. This is wild. So she's working in the company, rises through the ranks, and then just takes it out from under them.
Well, more or less. I think the guy was looking to exit. So it's not like
right,
she
right.
did
not
this
like
just
she
a hostile,
it, but, yeah.
hostile takeover. Yeah, yeah. Hostile takeover of the company. The guy, she pressured him. She's such a shark that she just manipulated this poor businessman. No, he was looking for it out and she just was there. It was great timing. And then it was logical that the people that, you know, came from nothing, the eldest son would join the family business. So I shifted majors. I was this business communications major with an emphasis in human resources, HR. And I joined this company and I was miserable. And but I had an opportunity to make a fine living and, you know, to have a house and a family and just sort of live the life that they wanted me to. But I think watching my mother take this huge risk in purchasing this company sort of empowered me to take that risk myself. So it's very easy to be complacent and just sort of sit in a job that is paying you. But I had this thing, you know, from a very young age, from back to 15 years old or 14 when I was at the comedy career day, you know, I definitely had the itch to try stand-up. So, and once I got in, just everything sort of took off. It was amazing.
So your early material then was drawn from you doing this work for your mom, or was
never has been, never really talked about it on stage, tried to talk about it, realized that the crowd just hated, it was people like, oh no, we hate the guy that fires people. and I hated myself for firing people. So like, they had it coming. If that's any makes you feel more sympathetic to me.
Full Chicago. Just, yeah. They only had themselves to blame.
They really did. Yeah. So anyway, I just rarely talked about it. When I was on stage, you know, when you're in it for the first 2 years, you really, I can remember a couple of jokes, but I'm embarrassed to even repeat them.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Were your family massively political? So you have a Sicilian mother, Mexican dad.
Correct. Yeah.
Right.
Pretty intense.
So how was that in your house growing up? Like politically, do you have an earliest political memory? Do you see like a protest or on TV?
Oh, I do. And a lot of Latinos in the United States were conservative because my dad, raised Catholic. Both my parents went to Catholic, you know, parochial schools in their respective neighborhoods. And, you know, Latinos, My dad was certainly one that liked to kick the ladder out. And he was very generous with his friends, but just felt like, I work for this, this is mine. And the mentality that he was not going to share anything with anyone. And until immigration became an issue in the United States, they were both Republican because they were greedy. They were voting with their pocketbook. But at this point, you know, my father has since passed away, but my mom is, I think, you know, anything to get Donald Trump out of office, and just very, very liberal in her thinking and wants to, you know, give as much of her money away as she possibly can.
I think there's a really interesting thing there, what you said about your dad kind of kicking the ladder out. I think sometimes we can have less empathy for people that are like us because we go, we managed to do it. You know, that kind of bootstraps narrative?
Sure.
We got ourselves out of the shit and into a place where we're doing well for ourselves. So actually, you can do it as well. Like, and I mean, there's that old saying that you start off like kind of left and then you get older and older and people get more right wing as they get older.
Yeah, I found that with quite a few of my friends, you know, that the opposite has happened, especially, you know, Donald Trump was so polarizing. And so it was such a traumatic thing to have him as president for 4 years. And I'm so glad that his, you know, microphone has been disconnected for the time being. So I really do think that we found out who a lot of people are in the United States. I was on stage when he was running for office and saying, where are you? Where are you? Just raise your hand. I know there's 40% of you. There's a chance. And I think you fall into three categories. I think you're either idiots, racist, or just greedy. That's it. That's all I can, or a combination of all three. But where are you? I just, I remember one guy, I go, oh, it's brave. And he goes, why? It's just, you forgot. Religious, you know, just I come from a very Christian family. And then to my point, it's like, how could you support such a heathen if you were going to? Yeah, then okay, all right, so you're religious. He's against everything that you preach about.
What you regard to be moral, like crazy. Kind of family values, right?
Ridiculous. There's, you know, a huge evangelical voting block here in the United States, and I just can't believe they don't see these people for who they really are.
Yeah.
We found out who all of those people were. My neighbor, you know, an old super conservative neighbor, I didn't realize I had been sort of taking care of this 89-year-old man in our neighborhood. I bring his trash cans up. My son would bring his garbage up his dry long driveway. And I would check in on him occasionally just to see how he's doing. And he would then bring me fruit from his fruit trees and walk down. And I said, so Vince, who do you like in this election? What do you like? And he goes, I'm for Trump. And I go, oh, hey, so Vince, why are you for Trump? The economy. And I go, well, what about all of these racism? And we can start there. What about all these people being trapped in the border? And just, this is like treated inhumanely. And what about the hypocrisy? And it's just listed off a couple of things. And he goes, the problem is the Chinese. And I go, oh, okay. I say, first of all, you know, my wife's Korean, which is not the same thing. But, you know, you've met my wife and been nice to my wife. And then, you know, I'm Latino. And so I'd really like to talk to you a bit about this. And there's just like, what am I trying to do? I mean, he's 89 years old. Oh, so hopefully all of these people die off or go so far to the right that which they have, that we see them for who they really are, these nut jobs. And it looks like that super conservative party here is, you know, split in two and with no hopes of ever banding back together again.
Well, at what point there must be some kind of disconnect in someone's head, though, when they're going, we got to worry about the Chinese, or it's, you know, the economy, it's immigration, you know. Oh, but I don't mean you. He worries about these things, but he does, like, are you an exception to them? I don't understand the disconnect from thinking, I think this way and this is the way I vote, as opposed to what I'm seeing is the opposite of that. These are people in my neighborhood.
Yeah. And that's, it's also another silly thing that I was doing where I was, you know, I live in a very white conservative neighborhood with nice homes, and I'm walking around as the good Latino saying hi to everybody. Hey, look, Mexicans are great. I'm one of them. Nice to see you. Hi, how are you? And so I just don't know what goes through people's heads. You know, I remember in the Daily Show doing a gay marriage piece in the Deep South and realizing that people were horrible behind closed doors. But once you were in their face with it, they were all super polite and Southern. And so Maybe that's a bit of it. You know, when you're in the voting booth, you know, something sort of takes over. But when you're standing in front of them, super, super polite and cordial.
It's fascinating to me as well, because you're talking about being in a white neighborhood. And I suppose in America, I think stuff is split more racially, I guess, in terms of like, I always thought of America as being the melting pot, but actually you see like communities, you'll have like Koreatown, or you'll have like Italy, and you have neighborhoods where it's actually not so much of a melting pot. It's people, communities tend to kind of like stick together in, you know, I don't know why that is. Is it a sense of home away from home? My boyfriend's Scottish Italian. So in Glasgow and Edinburgh, there's a big Scottish Italian community.
Amazing.
There you have all the Italian restaurants, and it's just that thing of people wanting to.
Yeah, they cluster together. Yeah. Just, and I think, you know, in not too far away, there's a city called Glendale in California where all the Armenians have gone. Like the, that is an Armenian controlled city. And same thing, it's, you know, there's, like you said, there's Filipino town, and it's just sort of comfort in numbers, and just they have the network.
And that's the idea of America, right, though? The idea of America is kind of like built on immigration. This idea that people can come and create a life for themselves, and they, there was a beautiful piece in your Half Like Me, which if you get a chance, anyone listening, you should watch this, because it's where Al sort of delves into the fact that he's his Mexican heritage versus being American, or being Americanized, as you describe it. But there's a great bit where you meet a guy who borders the, like, is a patrol, is border patrol, not like official, volunteers.
He was actually a guy that started the Minutemen, and his name escapes me since that was such it was a while ago. But he was the head of the Minutemen, so they were self-patrolling the wall. They took it upon themselves. They were a little militia that served as these unofficial border guards, armed border guards. And then he had a Mexican wife, half Mexican grandkids, three chihuahuas, was going home to drink a margarita, he said. And so he didn't just love Mexican culture. Like, he married, you know, a Mexican, was in it, and still was wanting, you know, there to be no Mexicans, you know, in at all in the United States, or immigrating to the United States illegally. Whereas if, you know, we were overrun with Swedes, I really don't think that it would be a problem.
That's fascinating to me. You know, you sort of grow up in a household. Did you speak Spanish? Was that part of your family?
No. My dad had such a hard time growing up, so he sent me to French school. He sent me to Notre Dame des Victoires. So I took 14 years of French, and my Spanish is embarrassing. So if we had the time machine, I definitely would have started stand up earlier and spoke Spanish, taken Spanish in high school instead of coasting through some French.
Do you think it's important to have like that sense of identity, you know, in terms of your, I suppose, in your career, in terms of writing and comedy and everything else?
I used to really identify as a San Franciscan. I sort of let go of that a bit because there's this big rivalry between Los Angeles and San Francisco. But in terms of like stand-up and material and fodder for stand-up and your writing. I've always loved comedians who open up on stage, talk about themselves. And so it just gives you, you know, when you have a rich background, it just gives you, you know, like I said, more material to pull from. I never really took to comedians that were just up there pretending to be someone else or a character or anything like that. Just didn't have any time for them, or to not a fan of one-liner comics. I appreciate it. I totally get it. Like Mitch, of course, I think was a genius, and there was a lot of personal stuff in there. It was, you know, his act was very him, but people that were just up there telling jokes were never really for me. I identify with the storytellers, and to be a storyteller, you have to have a sort of rich, full life.
Were there any of those sort of storytellers who you sort of embraced in terms of stand-up, any influences that you, apart from the ones that lived on your block and stuff like that, are there like sort of filmmakers or writers who do that kind of thing that you looked at and went, they're revolutionary, they've opened something up in my mind, a portal?
Three stand out, or two in particular. Dana Gould. I loved how he was able to do characters. I love people that are telling longer stories and acting out all those characters and doing voices along the way. And so Dave Chappelle, Dana Gould, Patton Oswalt does that. You know, I think Maron is fantastic as a comic. And so just always latched on to those long form storytellers that were, you know, performing all of these and, you know, a variety of characters. Growing up, Eddie Murphy was every single child my age listened to Eddie Murphy raw and delirious. And again, you know, doing all those different impressions along the way of family members, and I thought it was genius. And so, those were my big sort of four influences, I think.
What's your first sort of like political memory?
Well, actually, I'll show you this. This is my first political memory, is right behind me. And I know this won't show up, but that is a picture of me in my little French sailor suit outfit that I'm showing.
You're so cute. You're so adorable. Thank you.
So that's when I was 5 years old, and I was chosen by our school. Think that's Valerie Etcherin, but probably haven't seen her too much since. But that is Mayor George Moscone, who was actually assassinated.
Wow.
Yes. And I think that is the first memory. I was chosen to go and visit and the mayor of San Francisco. And at that time, I mean, it's a big, big deal, major city. Yeah, that's easily my first political memory, because they were so happy that I got to do that. In terms of my parents, I don't remember them ever really talking to me about politics too much. I do know that they went to vote every single opportunity they had. So they were very clear. I remember standing in line with them voting. And so we instill that in our children. My son was very happy, turned 18 this year. So went to vote for the first time and took a picture with his voting sticker. And it was very cute. So I knew that they definitely believed in the process, and know that my dad just hustled so much to make things work. But, you know, as my mom is this, you know, working her way up at that company, not making any money at all, my dad is trying to sell wine, and he was an artist who also sold art to pay for our tuition at the fancy French school that we went to. So I just think my parents were so exhausted that from working that he wanted to come home and watch the Lawrence Welk show and watch just nonsense and sit down and have his dinner and then go to sleep and then wake up and do it all over again. So we were, I think even, and potentially, like, and I'll have to talk to my mom about this, but intentionally sheltered as well.
Right. That makes sense. If they're working hard to kind of get up the next kind of step up the ladder and kind of go, this is the life we want for our kids. Sometimes you don't have time to be political. What you're doing is political. Your life is, you know, trying to live that dream and elevate your family.
And that's the other thing is, you talked about it a little bit, but there's very few Latinos in stand-up comedy. There's very few Latinos in television and filmmaking. Same with the Asian population here is having a very difficult time breaking into TV because we really aren't told that these are jobs. And with the job that they want as they're working and breaking their backs for us to take on and get these educations, it's lawyer, doctor, you know, stockbroker, something they can brag to their friends about. But when you say my daughter is painting, yeah. That's only a rich person can brag about that. Yeah. You know?
Yes.
It's like any other person that's, you know, is struggling is, you know, what? They're painting? Like, and maybe that attitude has changed, but probably not. It's something to be embarrassed about.
Do you think that's a barrier for entry into a career in the arts broadly in the States? Do you think the class element is a big thing?
Yeah, because they don't see that there's any money in it at this point. And we need money now. You need to be rich. I know a lawyer if you get your law degree, I know a lawyer is going to make $120,000 a year, whatever it is. But I don't know what happens when you get your comedy degree, if there's any guarantee for a certain amount of income.
Yeah, we've probably done as much training as lawyers, but yes, there's no certainties around. You're not going to go to this firm. You're not going to go to the comedy store and be their number one top.
Yeah.
And it's meritocratic, but it's also not. I mean, like in the UK, we have the Edinburgh Fringe. And it's such an amazing thing. And it is like the opening golf in that everyone can do it. However, the barriers to entry are you've got to be able to afford to go up there for a month. So, you know, if you have a family or a young family, that's not necessarily doable. If you're young and if your parents have money, basically you can because it costs you like, you know, thousands of pounds to get the PR, to hire the venue, to get your posters, to get all the stuff done. Then you've got to get up there and sell tickets. So you've got, you know, most Edinburgh shows take throwing 10 or 20 grand. And who has that money just like floating around unless you're loaded mm-hmm. or your family are loaded?
Well, do you find that, I've never even considered it, considering that I have a young family, but now that the kids are almost out the door completely, I might entertain it. So that's what I think I could go back at this point with my
yes.
20,000 and
right.
just and set myself up. And do you see comics doing that? Do more established comics ever come back once they've...
More established? Well, like Mickey Flanagan, who'd been just like an absolute hero on the club circuit forever in the UK, was 12 years into stand-up before he ever did in Edinburgh. And the great thing about Edinburgh is that you can still win newcomer no matter how long you've been going. So you get acts like kind of turn up who are like seasoned, incredible, amazing stand-up comedians. And, you know, they can come in and bring an hour and everyone like loses their mind.
Oh, amazing. Cool.
Yeah, yeah. So right. So you could, I mean, Chris Gethard did it a couple of years ago. That kind
oh,
of
awesome.
Yeah, and he did a show about depression. It was very funny, but he did a brilliant, brilliant show. And so I think you can. Yeah, you can be on the other side of that when you can afford to go into it. But I think a lot of the careers here in the arts, acting especially, you have to be able to afford to go to drama school in the UK. That's such a... I didn't, and I got an agent when I was a kid, and I sort of fluked my way into a lot. You say dabble. I'm kind of like, I just kind of got lucky, and this agent took me on, and I kind of landed a couple of jobs. But you know, the barriers for entry into like acting here, you need to be able to afford to go to one of the acting schools or a private school. And then the people who are making the shows also go to those schools and the people who run the TV channels. So class is a big part of it here.
Well, if you think about what I did with all things comedy.
Yes.
There's the barrier to same barrier to entry here in the States. You know, everybody went to these Ivy League schools. You know, all of the network TV executives might be a little bit more diverse now, but they just went to Princeton just like their, you know, their boss did. So I started my own network that is producing television shows and on its way. We are the number one comedy podcast network in the world. It's all things comedy.
This isn't a tiny revolution. This is a big revolution because I feel, I don't want to say activism, but it's a really, really important thing. So it's you and Bill Burr, right? You set this up.
Correct. And so we just wanted to create a fair system where we have complete transparency, where we're not hiding money from anyone. When we do produce something, all of the money goes into that particular project. And we are, you know, we had a big documentary come out here, the Patrice O'Neill documentary that hopefully you can watch, Killing is Easy. And have had a ton of specials. We produced Bill's special, Ronnie Chang's special, Ian Edwards' special. Jessica
I was at
Kirsten's
Ronnie's.
Special.
I was
oh,
at the recording of that. Yeah, in Glendale, right?
Yeah. That looked great. Yeah, didn't it? Wasn't that fantastic?
It was amazing. I love it. So the economy of his writing is, he's phenomenal.
He really is incredible.
I didn't know you guys had produced it, but you could tell that it was people who knew comedy by the way the setup, like the theater, how it was done, how it looks. Also, editing. I just feel when I watch specials, you need comedians. Either the comic who's there in the edit, preferably going like the shots, punch in here, because this you need to come in here and then pull back out here when I do the punchline. Like it's such a niche specific skill, I think. So I think you really see that in Ronnie's.
Yeah, it's we have gotten really good at it because we really do care and we want exactly what Ronnie wants. There's no other agenda other than let's take care of Ronnie here and make sure that we are able to. And he watches it. It's called Asian Comedian Destroys America on Netflix. And, you know, just because it's so good, but that's yes. exactly what he wanted. So we're just delivering on, you know, his sort of idea of what he wants the special to be. And so we're doing that with Bill. We're doing it with Whitney Cummings. If we did a robot special, we're just trying to help the comedian achieve their goal of, you know, whatever that may be. So, yeah, that's where it can. It is disruptive because I don't like being a pawn in anybody else's game. I'm auditioning and tap dancing for all of these executives in hopes that I might make $20,000. No.
Yeah.
I remember I was on a movie and watching all of the producers drive up and eat filet mignon on plates and drink Fiji water. And I was like, oh, yeah, I want that. And yeah. But I just also want that level of control so I can make sure that my friends don't get screwed over too. So that's a huge part of this. And if we're able, I'll tell you what the ultimate goal is that I really want to have a comedian pass away. I've had a lot of comedians pass away on me that I've been friends with, but one in particular was my friend from starting out in San Francisco to sort of bring it full circle. And he died really because he had no health insurance.
Wow.
And so what I want to do with all things comedy ultimately is provide a clinic that comedians can go to. I'm not sure if I can, I think I can provide ultimately like, providing health insurance is incredibly, incredibly expensive. But if I could just pay physicians to do, well, yeah, I'd have to unionize and it would be much more complicated than me. I've given this a lot of thought than me opening up my own clinic and employing doctors on for a 2-week period that could open up a facility and schedule appointments so I could get comedians physicals every single year. So if I can get all of these actors and performers annual physicals, then we could start there and make sure we nip anything in the bud and then take care of.
That's beautiful. That's a phenomenal thing to do. So I just want to say that that's really amazing.
No, we'll get there eventually, but that seems like the most achievable way to see that people get some sort of health coverage by recognizing, you know, anything before it becomes a bigger problem. And then once we discover somebody has cancer, then it's on them.
One of the huge things I think about America versus here, and I sort of started talking about it recently in stand-up, I guess, in relation to drinking, why Americans, I think, drink less than the UK, because we have health insurance. And I think the first time I've ever been to hospital was a drink-related injury. And they fix that shit for free, right?
Yeah.
So we just drink so much because we're like, less consequences.
Totally.
But even within that, even within the idea that comedians could support each other, a friend of mine had a heart attack here, and we sort of, and it wasn't that he couldn't pay his hospital bills and he had operations, but also the fact that he couldn't work. Like, he's a comic who plays clubs. So he's like, got to take 6 months off. And even after that, they're like, the amount of adrenaline and everything else we get when we do stand up, you know, we're like dealing with huge spikes and the body chemicals are going crazy. So he's like, they're like, we'd like you to not perform for an extended period of time. So the comedians set up this kind of like, there was a big benefit gig, and we just, you know, and I think that sort of runs now. I don't know how much money it has in it, but there were lots of comedians will do gigs, and then we've got this pot of money to kind of go, no one else wants to look out for us, so we have to look out for each other.
Yeah. And I've been incredibly realistic when I got into this and just knew that I never wanted to be in a position where I needed to do stand-up comedy over the age of 50.
Right.
So I say, if I cannot get to the point where I'm relying on this for an income, because I just don't want to be desperately popping around from paid gig to paid gig and dealing with the same assholes, the people yelling out. So,
but also not just people who are in the audience, people who run venues and gigs.
Oh, they're the worst.
There are some great clubs and great people, but there's also some real assholes. And none of us, we didn't want a boss. That's why most of us got into this. Then you find yourself dealing with a series of mini bosses.
Sure.
So this guy at this joint never wants to book me because he doesn't like me, or, you know, so and so.
Yeah, it's another big goal of mine to take all of their power away.
Yes.
And so in the United States, so there's no reason why that we can't form a network of independent venues and enable a transparent white label ticketing system, so you can see exactly how many tickets have been sold. You can use our marketing platform to help promote the gigs. But yeah, I think these club owners, these mini bosses that you're talking about are a huge problem. And again, you know, there's small business owners that are trying to make it work, but a lot of them are, people are there to see the comedy, and they're treating the comedians like shit. So we were going to take that over as well. Just all in good time. I was cautioned early on not to be like Yahoo and try to do too much, you know, try to do everything. So we wanted to be great at distributing audio. And I think we're really good, but we're getting better every single week. And then we want to be, great at great producers. And then we'll start to hang ticketing and more stuff off of this as we go along. But in terms of the revolution, like, whatever it is that you want to do, I really encourage people listening to this just to take over. Don't be complacent and really try to be disruptive, and whatever that thing is that's, you know, nagging you constantly. And if you do have some little bug to start a company or bake professionally, whatever it is, just do it as soon as possible. Because if I could, I would definitely go back in time, like we talked about, and start earlier, and I'd be speaking Spanish and not French, and a more established comic.
How do you deal with criticism, and does it affect the work?
Yeah, not better now. I used to be someone that would read comments. Now I've gotten off all social media pretty much, so I'm 100% off of everything. I'll log in maybe once every 2 months, because I think, again, Facebook is for my mom. Instagram is just a huge distraction that makes you think it's just everyone's living these glorious, rich lives. And Twitter is just evil. Twitter just makes you feel horrible about yourself. Even if you're just reading the news, the last thing you want to do is just you scroll through and you start looking at all the comments. It's very upsetting. So I'm off of all of it, and I've never been happier or more productive. And, you know, I think, like we started talking about, COVID made me realize what's important, and happiness is really important to me. And so I have been trying to meditate, and I just feel like I'm at my best right now. And
you cover sort of all my questions before I ask them. So I love that, because I was going to say, what are the things that you think have helped you in your creative life? So meditating is up there, is it? Getting off social media.
Get off social media, because you just really don't need to be on it. If you're a comedian, you're like, oh, I need to promote gigs. You really don't, because there's a lot of... that shouldn't be on us.
Right.
it just shouldn't. Yeah. And it just doesn't matter. Because you look at, there's so many successful actors and comedians that don't have anything. In terms of, I think you're just doing it for you so you can let other people know what you've been up to. And there's a lot of ego involved there. And so once you drop that ego, realize what's important to you, and just focus on that, and just really taking it all in. There's this, you know, mindfulness approach to, I've been going on a lot of long walks starting in COVID, and just really noticing things that I didn't take in before. I think you do such a great job of it. In London, I made so many people like a walk to a Sunday roast or whatever. Like I want to do that every single Sunday. So I'm, I just love walking in a park and the meditation of it all. And it allows me to focus again on what I love, which is, you know, I love hanging out with friends. I love my family. And that's just seeing everyone around me happy makes me so happy. I love, you know, I really enjoy traveling and exploring. So success in stand-up and success in comedy and success with all things comedy is just going to allow me to, you know, take more walks in nice places.
That's really, really lovely. I think happiness is such a huge thing. I was speaking to another comic about this recently, and I said, I feel like this job or this career can make you postpone your happiness constantly. And what am I postponing it for? And the pandemic has done that for me. It's made me go, I want to feel joy and sort of magic in my days and have now, mm-hmm. not what am I going to get in a year's time? And am I going to book this show? And am I going to do this thing? And I may not get all the things, but I'm going to get all the right things. I'm going to get the things that are right for me.
Sure.
So my daily is like, I get up and I write down all the stuff I'm thankful for.
Right.
Yeah. It's just a really nice way of bringing me into the room to go, oh, I've got so many like things to be grateful for and to be happy about. I love the walking as well. And you're like Hemingway. Hemingway walks before he used to walk before he wrote. That was his morning routine. You mentioned meditating as well. Do you meditate on the walk? Do you do like a guided?
I don't. I listen to a lot of music, a lot of podcasts on the walk, and then try to, there's a great app called Insight Timer. So you can just pick the whatever meditation, but there is a meditation for creatives that's on there that, ooh, you can search. Connecting with your creative muse on Insight Timer, and it's it seems like a fake name of this woman is guiding it, but it's Glenda Cedarleaf.
Perfect.
But I listen to that, you know, yeah, any sort of just breathing or realizing, you know, making you focus on what's important, because getting caught up in just nonsense and then the drama that'll find its way to you in politics or, you know, in your life, there's always going to be some sort of disruption. I remember with this new attitude, I ran into a dad who was complaining about our daughter's school so much that he pulled the daughter from the school. And my daughter, he had convinced me just to put the daughter in the school. So I said, he was complaining about it, and I go, what if you just went into this thinking that it wasn't going to be perfect? and there was always going to be problems, and there was going to be a bad teacher, and there was going to be grades that you didn't agree with, and there was going to be this administrators that you didn't agree with, and, blah, blah, blah. And just what if you went into that with the attitude that nothing is going to be, you know, ideal? And I go, would I be okay then? And he goes, yeah. And he made him really think about it. Like, he was approaching something, just thinking that this school was going to be perfect. Well, guess what? No school is perfect. And no situation is perfect. And no audience is going to be perfect. And then when they are, you're just, Buddhist mentality that sort of...
Let go of perfection is really beautiful. Just let go of the idea of... It's crippling, right?
Oh, for sure. Because, you know, I especially with stand-up, if we bring it all back to stand-up, like, you know, these crowds or situations or rooms or audience, it's never going to be ideal. And when it is ideal, that you can get off stage and go, well, that's great. That's why I do it. But, when it's not, it's like, yeah, that's, what do you think you're doing here? You're performing in front of a bunch of drunks. You know, when the show goes bad in Miami, who wants to listen to a guy stand up and talk for an hour in Miami?
There's a beach right there, guys.
Yeah, they should be dancing and humping each other with very little clothes on.
Thank you so much, Al Madrigal, for joining me on Tiny Revolutions.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can listen to other programs from The Bugle, including The Bugle, The Last Post, Tiny Revolutions, and The Gargle, wherever you find your podcasts.
I'm Andy Bush. I'm here to tell you about our weekly board games podcast that you might just love, called Bush's Board Game Thing. Every week, me, Brian, and Eloise get together, sit around a table, play a few board games, and mainly just go off on massive tangents about life and stuff like that. It's less about the minutiae of the board games themselves. What we love is the fact that games bring people together and can spark conversation. Each week, we have a terrible board game fact from Brian, which absolutely makes him ramble into the wall. And one of you guys get in touch to pitch us a board game that hasn't been made yet. Our favourite so far was an extremely tired dad who came up with a board game about camping and going for a wee in a hedge. Bush's Board Game Thing, give it a listen. It might just change your life.
Tired of ads intruding into your favourite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.